Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Events in Libya are changing rapidly. Opposition forces say they've taken control of the capital, Tripoli, but pockets of pro-Gaddafi forces continue to put up a fight. Joining me in the studio to talk about what's happening and what's next for Libya and its influence on uprising elsewhere, Robin Wright of the Woodrow Wilson Center, David Schenker of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, Nadia Bilbasi of Middle East Broadcast Center. Throughout the hour, I'll look forward to hearing your comments, questions, and as events on the ground change, we will be hearing about those. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Quite a rapid change of events, Robin. What do the rebels control at this point that we know?
Well, the reports out of Tripoli indicate that they control most of the capital, perhaps as much as 95%. This is a critical turning point. This is the end of Muammar Gaddafi's 42-year rule. We're beginning what I think is also phase two of the Arab uprisings. This is going to, I think, spur events, kind of inject some adrenaline in other parts of the region. But whether it lasts hours or days, Muammar Gaddafi is now finished.
Nadia Bilbasi, what happened that allowed these troops to advance so strongly into Tripoli?
Well, if you remember, Diane, last time we were in the show, we talked about this place called Bir el-Ghanam, and I said at the time that it was very significant gain for the rebels. And the fact that they were pushed by the support of NATO, of course, which has played a vital role, a very important role, they decided to take it all the way to Tripoli. And some reports indicated that from Misrata, they walked 20 to 30 miles to descend on the capital. What was the final point that make them take that military decision, we still don't know. But the fact that they did it and the city crumpled overnight, we've seen this jubilation of hundreds of thousands of people yesterday in what used to be called Green Square, now it's called Martyr Square, after, of course, how many people were killed in the battle to liberate Tripoli in particular. We have to see now the situation is very precarious. The security situation in particular is, where is Gaddafi? Some say that he's held in Bab al-Aziziyah, which is the place where his compound, his whereabout is not known. Whether he's still there or not, we don't know.
And David Schenker, the key to all this could be where Gaddafi is, whether he will surrender. What do you expect here?
Well, we saw that his leading deputy for the past 30 years or so was interviewed publicly, and he said Gaddafi won't surrender, and a terrible quote, actually. He says he doesn't have the courage like Hitler to kill himself. I don't see Gaddafi surrendering. We heard very early on in the fighting that they would fight to the last bullet, but that last bullet is quickly coming to an end. I think he's looking for a safe landing right now. And there are a limited number of places he can go. The typical refuge for these type of dictators would be Saudi Arabia, but in 2004, Gaddafi was implicated in a plot to kill then Crown Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, so they're likely not to take him. You could look at some other countries. Venezuela has been a very good friend for Gaddafi. Even Pakistan, he provided sanctuary to the Bhutos some years ago. And finally, another good choice would be Sudan, but there's others, Chad, etc. This is really going to be an issue for the ICC to look at. Saif Islam has already been demanded by the ICC. The rebels will turn him over for justice. And this may go on for some time.
But how important is it, Robin Wright, to find Gaddafi, to bring him to trial?
it's very important for not only Libya, but the entire region. And I think it comes at a time, very interesting time, where you see Hosni Mubarak of Egypt and his two sons standing trial. And there is a sense for the first time in the region that justice may be achievable, that leaders can be held to account. And whether it's a local trial or the International Criminal Court, there's a sense that Gaddafi should face some kind of tribunal. I think the issue will be, you know, where. But the turning point, in many ways, in the last 24 hours, was the arrest of Saif al-Gaddafi. This was the son who was not only his political heir apparent, but the man who had navigated Gaddafi's reentry into the international community, his surrender of weapons of mass destruction, his, you know, compromise on Pan Am 103. And without Saif around to counsel him on ways out, without him to help navigate the kind of, whether it's a surrender or that last phase, this will be tough. And the son he will be relying on is Khamis, who is the commander of a key military unit protecting Tripoli. And so the dynamics on the ground, who is Gaddafi listening to? Who is giving him this critical advice at the end of his political career will help determine what happens next. And of course, it's the military son rather than the political son.
David.
Yeah, I think that's an important thing, the Gaddafi son and what type of advice he gets. But the fact of the matter is, I think the turning point really was that NATO actually changed the nature of its operations. You know, it had gone in with the UN Security Council Resolution 1973, which basically said that the obligation was to protect the people of Libya, to prevent the massacre of Benghazi. And we saw this thing was a very drawn-out operation because it basically stuck to that. But in the last few days, you had the nature of the operations changed dramatically. So you had NATO flying sorties and hitting defensive positions in Tripoli of Gaddafi's forces. They hit 40 targets in and around Tripoli in just the last 2 days. This was unprecedented. And I think the regime was already brittle. But this really, I think, pushed it over the edge and allowed the rebels to move on.
But even yesterday, Nadia, Gaddafi went on state television and said, get out and take your weapons, all of you. There should be no fear. How many Gaddafi loyalists are actually left?
Well, this is very true, actually. And the funniest thing, he appealed to the Islamists. He says to the Muslims there, go and fight on my behalf because this is your way to heaven, which is typical of Gaddafi's code of erratic behavior. But I think the fact that what we have seen last night, these amazing pictures of thousands of people, very, very obviously happy to see the rebels among them. There were gunshots all over and people are celebrating and embracing each other. That it shows that actually it's not what we thought, that Tripoli is not completely under the support of Gaddafi. But saying that, there is also reports saying that up to 60,000 troops, and we're talking about the Libyan army. As Robin said, his son Khamis is in charge of one of the brigades that's considered the most ruthless and the most loyal and the backbone of the Libyan army, which is not, of course, comparable to any other army in the Middle East because he kept it on purpose undeveloped because he didn't want somebody to overthrow him. But I think this is really important to see now, where are the 60,000 loyalists?
Yeah.
Are they going to stand for him? Are they going to give up? And basically, but we had reports that in Misrata itself and other cities, already the brigades belong to Gaddafi, already siding with the rebels. Let me just add one more point about the sons. I think the arrest of Saif al-Gaddafi is very important because he was considered the de facto ruler. He was the one who's groomed to take after his son. But also, there's two other sons being arrested, Muhammad and Saadi. Muhammad gave an interview in Arabic yesterday to Al Jazeera, and he was saying basically that he was under house arrest, that the TNC rebels basically did not harm him. And this is very, very important indication of how the rebels are going to deal with the Gaddafi sons. He's not considered an important son because he was from the previous wife. He wasn't playing an important role in politics. Saadi is the same. If you remember when they imposed no-flight zone, he said, I can go hunting. This is, you know, so he's not considered really that important son either. So I think Khamis and Saif al-Islam are very important, but the Libyan people wanted Saif al-Islam to be tried in Libya, not in the ICC, just like Mubarak and his sons are tried in the country.
Right, Ben.
Oh, absolutely. It's very funny when you look at Gaddafi appealing to the Islamists, because this is, he was so nervous about whether it's the Muslim Brotherhood or the group called the Islamic Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, that he warned about the cancer that threatened Libya. And today he's now appealing to virtually anyone. I will say that on the question of the military, Libya's military is weak. It's engaged in some actions in neighboring countries in small ways. But a lot of the Arab armies are actually much weaker than their numbers would indicate. They still have the big equipment. But in these final days, they will also know their future. And they will look to the identity of their tribe, their clan, their family, as the unit with which they want to be seen, not necessarily the leader. And I think one of the most telling interviews was yesterday. I think it was on CNN, where the young woman said that up until yesterday, people weren't talking to each other, their neighbors, even telling them whether they sided with Gaddafi or with the rebels, because they were so afraid of being turned in. They didn't make cell phone calls. And that once the rebels started moving into Tripoli, there was this outpouring, and they suddenly discovered their neighbors were all against Gaddafi, too. And it was this profound moment that you see happening across the entire region, that suddenly you discover you're not alone in your opposition, that there are hundreds of thousands, millions, who are also looking for something different. They're tired of a life that is controlled, repressed, in which they have no stake in their current life or in their future.
Robert Wright, the Woodrow Wilson International Center. David Schenker of the Middle East Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Nadia Bilbasi of Middle East Broadcast Center. We'll take a short break and be right back. And welcome back. As we talk about unfolding events in Libya, where the rebels seem to have taken control of Tripoli. However, thus far, Gaddafi has not been located. Here in the studio, Nadia Bilbasi of Middle East Broadcast Center, David Schenker of Washington Institute for Near East Policy, Robin Wright. She's the author of a new book titled Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. Here's our first email from Claude in Cleveland Heights, Ohio. He says, this will be like the dog that chased the car. Now that he's caught, what will he do with it? The rebels are totally unprepared for success. The situation is certain to deteriorate into a chaotic bloodbath as tribal rivalries emerge, and has already been demonstrated by the brutal death of Abdel Fattah Yunus. That the U.S. is blindly supporting such an unfocused effort is troubling. What do you think, Robin?
Well, Libya is a very tribal society. There are estimated to be about 140 tribal entities or clans, 30 of which are important, three of which have been Gaddafi's traditional base. That is always a danger. Benghazi has witnessed some rivalries emerge, Benghazi being the second largest city and the home to the opposition government, the Transitional National Council. And there are two rival parts of Libya. I mean, you have, you know, the East and the West that are historic rivals. But having said that, I think the interesting dynamic is that you've had 5 months pass in which you have had an opposition council having to come to grips with the realities of how do you build civil institutions? How do you pick up garbage? How do you allow nascent civil society to begin to emerge? And the Benghazi experiment is quite interesting. I think we can't write off Libya. It is the one country of the 22 that has two critical ingredients for success. One is a small population, and the second is oil wealth.
Yeah.
Unlike Egypt and Tunisia and any other country, you have burgeoning populations, very limited resources, and frankly, an inability to address democratic demands anytime soon, whatever the will of the people. Libya is one country where they have the oil wealth to reconstruct. They have a small enough population to address their needs and improve their life in a way that the rewards will be tangible in a short enough time that it may not fall apart. And if you can give people a sense of a future and a physical reward in the 30% unemployment in Libya, if you can give them a job, reconstructing the country, you know, it may not be as bad as a lot of people fear.
David.
Yeah, no, I think Robin's absolutely right. The thing that differentiates Libya is the $40 billion a year in oil revenues and the small population. You have the Transitional National Council that is headed by two technocrats. But you do have also the fact that the country is not really a country. It never has been. It has no democratic representative traditions. It was divided into three until 1969, a little bit earlier. You have, Tripoli, you have Benghazi or Cyrenaica, and then in the south, you have, what do they call it, the Fezzan. And these places have never felt a unity or an alliance together, and people should be concerned. I mean, the idea that you have this ruthless dictator that has held together these 140 tribes, these 30 important tribes, for so long and suppressed the differences, would lead some people to say that the worst case scenario is another Iraq. Now, we're not looking at, because Iraq has a lot of oil revenue as well. We're not looking at Sunni Shias and Kurds. We're talking about all Sunni Muslims. But this would be a worst-case scenario.
Here's an email titled Pyrrhic Victory from Marion in Newport News, Virginia, who says, if Libya devolves into a fundamentalist Islamic state, NATO may very well rue the day they decided to intervene. Revolution could turn into civil war in Libya unless the sides can form some kind of coalition government. Whoever controls the oil will control Libya. Nadia.
Could be. Look, I mean, there's so many people who have the conventional wisdom to say that we don't know what's going to happen in the whole entire Arab world after all these uprisings and revolutions. The Islamists might come, they are most organized, the Salafists in Libya, the Muslim Brother in Egypt, etc. I actually tend to be on the opposite side. Yes, I'm cautious about the changes coming, but I'm optimistic. I think whatever is going to come is going to be much better than one state controlling the Arab world for 40 or 50 years, when having one dictator, the Arab generations, the young people are growing up to knowing one leader only, when the democracy changed 5 or 6. So regardless of the bigger pictures, yes, I understand the road ahead is going to be very, very hard and it's going to be paved with so many conflict. But Libya in particular, if I refer to some of the discussion here, I think another country in the Arab League is Somalia, is very similar, which is the tribal structure is similar to Libya in terms of you have so many of these tribes, and it ended to be a failed state. But Libya is going to be different because of the reason that Robin mentioned about the oil, and it's a smaller country. And also you have an opposition already, as you said, 5 or 6 months in training and supported by the West, etc. And I was impressed when I met Mahmoud Abdeljalil. He came here to Washington and he had a few discussion with few journalists. And I think they're actually on the right path. It's true that we're going to have so much of unpredictability. But in the long run, I think whatever is going to happen, it's going to take not overnight. I mean, we are very impatient. It's not going to take 5 months or 6 months or a year or two. We're talking about Latin America. The transfer from dictatorship to democracy, it takes 5, 10 years, maybe 15 years.
And
but we should be able to be willing to wait for that long.
Here's another email from Thomas, who says, please discuss how the U.S. will now be hit up for more foreign aid and funds to rebuild. Will Libya repay the U.S. for the cost of this war that we funded via NATO? They have oil, we have debt. Why should they not repay us, Robin?
Well, one of the big questions is, how you reconstruct the country. And this is where there is $33 to $36 billion of frozen assets by the Gaddafi regime in the United States alone. There is a lot of money. I doubt that they're going to end up repaying NATO or the United States, but they will use these resources to reconstruct the country. And this is why there is the prospect of something good coming out of this, not just the kind of tribal rivalry that we're all worried about. I will say that it's going to be messy. Democracy is messy. We will be nostalgic at some point for the days when we could call one leader like Hosni Mubarak in Egypt and get something done, whether it was on Arab-Israeli peace, dealing with al-Qaeda, the kinds of regional concerns we have. It'll take a long time for all of these diverse forces to learn how to work together and how to divide up the spoils economically or politically. The critical element down the road is writing a new constitution. That's when Iran's revolution was hijacked. It was a year and a half into its revolution when the cleric stepped in and said there's such chaos over creating a new political order that we're going to impose an Islamic superstructure on it. A lot can happen. One thing to remember, and that is that, 20 years after the demise of the Soviet Union, you still have a former KGB chief and communist in power, that in South Africa, a country we all think was incredibly noble in its transition, the majority of blacks are today worse off economically than they were under apartheid. So that transitions do take a long time. Latin America, Venezuela was the first democracy, and today it's ruled by a strong man. So this is going to be awkward, messy. Times will want to go in and say, we know how to do this, we'll help you. And what we have to do now is kind of different from Iraq. We have to let the Libyans themselves make the decisions. What is so legitimate about Libya's uprising, unlike Iraq, was they did it themselves. And it will be perceived in the region as credible in the way that Iraq was not.
David.
No, I think that's absolutely right. The key here is that people in Libya see an improvement in their daily lives in rapid fashion. Where this doesn't happen, I think you have slide toward authoritarianism. They just got rid of one and they'll get another. Eastern Europe, we see this with Russia. We saw this in many other states. We didn't see it in Poland because they managed to fix some things and do some dramatic reforms rather quickly. There are places like the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development that can help them fix these crippled bureaucracies in Libya. And they do a very good job at it. I don't think it's going to cost us money to do this. I think the Libyan people will be committed to it, but you do have an Islamist stream there that people will have to be careful about and pay attention to.
And do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us with your Facebook postings or your tweets. We see that reports are that communications are very backed up, even though rebels have seized control of state television. But the response around the world is interesting, Nadia, because flags of Gaddafi's government have come down, flags of the rebel movement have gone up.
This is true. This is what the scenes we saw last night is very similar to Tahrir Square. For a while, we haven't seen this in the Arab world, partly because Syria has cut off communication with the outside world. They didn't allow journalists to get in. And Egypt was the revolution that was televised. And what we've seen last night is the same thing. So we see these flags all over, people wrapping themselves with the flags, with the new slogan, and we have seen it in Washington on Wednesday when the new ambassador, who became now the chargé d'affaires of the TNC, has also put this flag on the old Libyan embassy. So this is significant. People are very euphoric, and it symbolized so many things for them to see this new flag, which represents a new day. But as we said, it is the day ahead that we're going to worry about.
Can we talk for a moment about the cost to the U.S. of its involvement in NATO forces trying to bring down Gaddafi? Robin.
I don't know what the price tag is. There have been over 7,500 sorties since March, and that's going to be a big major cost. But the fact is, the Europeans have done more. The United States has actually been fairly low profile during this period because it didn't want to be seen to be engaged in a third war. But the interesting thing is the political cost. And in this way, this is where the Obama administration, I think, comes out ahead, despite the frustration about how long it took. It did it, or will be perceived in the Arab world, in the international community, as having acted in a way that was collaborative, that this was a joint action, unlike Iraq, where the United States didn't get Arab approval, didn't get United States endorsement, had to build its own coalition. This time, the U.S. got an Arab League support, a U.N. resolution, and used and worked through the world's mightiest military alliance. And so the contrast couldn't be sharper between Iraq and Libya. And I think the political gains, the way the U.S. is perceived in the world, will be much more credible having gone this route, even though it took longer. We could have done it much faster, but it worked.
Robin Wright, the Woodrow Wilson Center, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Houston, Texas. Good morning, Geronimo. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. Very, very good morning. Just have a very quick question. It has been reported that with General June's death, there were some tensions within the rebels, that the rebels do not propose a unified front. So I was wondering if your panel can talk a little bit more about what does this mean for this transition of democracy, how these ethnic tensions will play, and obviously the political role in 2012 of the U.S. and the lack of money in order to finance this opportunity, as Secretary Clinton said the other day.
Nadia.
Well, yes, he's absolutely right. There is this division, and we talked about it in detail just now, actually. And we don't know how it's going to turn out, basically. But yes, there is a tribal division. There is a big difference between people in the East Coast and the West Coast, etc. The bottom line, as I said, is these people manage, regardless. It was a horrible incident with the killing of Abdel Fattah Yunus. And I heard yesterday Abdel Jalil saying, almost, who is the head of the TNC, saying he was almost going to resign over it. And there was an internal investigation. But putting this aside, I think they managed so far to do something, which is to hold themselves together as a political entity and also as a military front. There's no doubt that NATO played a huge role in supporting them and giving them the communication, and in this particular push on Tripoli. But together, we now are looking for the next step, which is they're about to elect 200 members of the assembly, and we have to see who's going to represent everybody. And basically, they're saying it's going to be inclusive. They're going to consider every tribe, every demand, everyone who the exile, people who've been anti-Gaddafi, people who were remnant of the regime who defected. So this is going to be a critical test to see how actually the TNC is going to handle handle themselves. And who's going to write the constitution is very, very important. We've seen it in Egypt. Who's going to have the upper hand to dictate in the ultimately how Libya is going to be shaped and how it's going to be turned out? But I will give them some credit, despite the fact that we said that democracy is very messy and it's going to be a critical time ahead. But I think they might be able to put something together.
Right.
I agree.
The CNN is reporting that the rebels have now taken most of Tripoli. A former aide says that Gaddafi is not likely to surrender.
I've interviewed Gaddafi a number of times, and this is, of all the world leaders I've talked to, he is the most unstable. I've always thought that there was some underlying medical issue. I think from his appearance and his performance publicly in the last few years, it appears he's on some kind of medication. But the thing that's, you know, I also think that he does not want to leave Libya. I think his inclination will be to fight. But I also think we may have reached the point where it's too late for him to find options. How is he going to fly out unless he is already outside of Tripoli? We've reached a point that the end game has unfolded so dramatically, so fast, that the options may be quite limited, and he may have to fight it out or surrender. And this is a man, because he is so unstable, may just keep on going until the end.
Robin Wright of the Wilson Center. Her new book is titled Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, dedicated to educating wonks to use knowledge to change the world. More at american.edu/wonk. By the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
A novel about five childhood friends and one long-kept secret. Mystery writer Laura Lippman with her latest book, exploring what happens when the past comes charging back. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back as we talk about unfolding events on the ground in Tripoli, with the rebels now having reached the point where CNN is reporting that they do control Tripoli. Robin Wright, you have talked to Muammar Gaddafi. You've gone into one of his tents. Describe that experience.
Well, one of the key places in Libya, maybe the most important when it comes to military installations, is Bab al-Azizia military barracks. And that's where I've always interviewed him. And it's a wild scene because it's a traditional military barracks, but they've brought in these quilts, what they've built into an enormous tent. And that's where he does receptions and he receives visitors. And they also brought in sand, and they have a couple of camels there. You know, it's trying to create this very strange desert environment. Now, his father was a Bedouin sheep herder, and he considers himself part of a desert culture. And they've imported this bizarre set of desert symbols into the chief military barracks. And one of the questions, of course, is at what point do the rebels take this over? This and kind of the government offices or the government, his key government and residential compound, will be the two places that they will want to seize most of all.
I just wanted to add what a year can make a difference in history. Last year, if you remember, we were talking about this controversial issue of Gaddafi wanted to be in the UN to address the General Assembly, which was about to report to again, and he wanted to build this tent. And it was a huge controversy as where this tent is going to be built, and the New York police was all involved, etc. And now we're talking about him fighting for his last days of his life. But, I mean, just wanted to add also one thing about his character, which you described very eloquently. He's a megalomaniac. I don't really see him handing himself in again. I cannot see Gaddafi wanted to be taken to the ICC or being in a cage like Mubarak. I think he would definitely prefer to die, somebody kill him, as he said, because he's too coward to kill himself. But I don't really see him being arrested.
There are reports that Gaddafi has fled to Algeria. But that said, I mean, if you want a detailed psychological analysis of Gaddafi, just go WikiLeaks. They had the U.S. ambassador at the time, Gene Kretz, wrote a scathing indictment of Gaddafi about how he is a big fan of flamenco dancing, and he talked about his European nurse and how he doesn't like to be on the second floor of buildings. And the guy clearly has some major issues.
Now, here's a posting from Facebook from Felix, who says, "Now we are stuck over there, and we are already overextended. Mutiny brings chaos. We are going to have to be over there to maintain law and order. How much is this going to cost us, David?"
Well, I don't think that we're stuck over there. We did a few air operations, a pretty major role in NATO supporting
the
European
air. Well, we took the lead in those air operations.
We took the lead initially, and then we played a supporting role. These were European planes that were primarily flying the sorties, you know, perhaps until the last days when they really needed to get things done in Tripoli. You know, that said, you know, we are not on the ground. They do have assets. And this was never a U.S. strategic interest. This was an interest of Europe that was afraid of all these Muslim Libyans coming across and into Europe and as emigres. It was an issue of oil. Italy gets 40% of its oil. France, 16% of Libyan oil. The United States only gets 2% of all Libyan oil. It's a drop in the bucket. So this was a European issue, and we did this to be part of NATO, I think. It was humanitarian. Now, if you want to look at a strategic issue, let's talk Syria. But Libya is not in any way something that the U.S. would consider getting in on the ground.
All right, to Upper Marlboro, Maryland. Good morning, Ty. You're on the air.
Good morning. I have a question about the leadership of this revolution. As it appears that the Gaddafi regime is you know, on the verge of collapsing, I wanted to know if there's any, like, George Washington-type figure that the Libyans have that they can rally around. I hear a lot about, you know, representatives in Washington representing, you know, the interests of the revolution and the rebels. And in Egypt, they have this vague kind of council of generals that's sort of running things now after that regime fell. And I wanted to know if there is a person in Libya like a George Washington.
I don't know if there is a George Washington anywhere that we can.
But is there a leader of these rebels?
Yeah, this is true. I mean, as we said before, there is not one single person that you can say, because it's a faction of different backgrounds and different tribes and, you know, different entities. But, I mean, the names that comes obviously is Mahmoud Jibril and Mustafa Abdel Jalil, and he's the head of the TNC. So, but he's saying that he's a temporary figure. He's only there until the government is, the new government is formed and new General Assembly is elected, etc. So he serves as a temporary or transitory kind of person. And it's even the same for the ambassador here. He was not given the title of the ambassador because they think this is only a temporary thing until the Libyan people elect a government. So you have something of a transitional council, but you don't have one person as such.
In many ways, that's a good thing, that you have not one figure taking over, one dictator taking over from another, that this is a collaborative effort, that they have all been part of this. They've had to go through, they've had a lot of their own problems, divisions within. They've had to go through a purge in the aftermath, or a kind of a sorting out process in the aftermath of the murder of this general who had once fought with Gaddafi and defected and was critical in leading the rebels. But there is a sense, unlike Egypt and Tunisia, that there is a collective that is taking power. And that really is so critical to this next phase, that they're talking about elections, holding elections quickly to replace them, that they're not claiming to be the national representatives, only to be the temporary interim leaders.
And they're incredibly credible. I mean, if you look at it, you know, Abu Jalil was the former Supreme Court justice of, and he the Minister of Justice in Libya, and he resigned because of excessive violence of Gaddafi. Mahmoud Jibril himself, you know, has a doctorate in management. He's a very impressive individual from an American university. So, you know, these guys are credible, I think, on the ground. And if you wanted anybody to be able to manage this transition,
and Saidu of Cincinnati, Ohio, says Nadia earlier mentioned this news as the beginning of the second round of the Arab uprising. Do you believe Algeria, Morocco, Mauritania will follow?
What I said is what we have seen last night is definitely galvanized the Arab world once again. These scenes we have not witnessed since Cairo, since Tahrir Square. I don't know about Algeria and Morocco and Mauritania, because each Arab country has its own dynamics. Morocco, for example, the king was very quick to introduce these reforms and to be inclusive, and we have not seen them on the massive scale. And Algeria somehow kind of kept away. We have not seen demonstrations, but I think Syria, it will give a push for Syria now. I think this is the country that we have to watch.
I was actually the one who said that it was phase two, and I do believe that Syria is the most important country in the Middle East right now. This is a place where that is because of its strategic location, because it's involved in on so many fronts, whether it's the Arab-Israeli peace process, Turkey to the north, Iraq on another border, Jordan and Lebanon, that it, strategically it's pivotal. But it's also the place where you've seen in many ways the toughest and most resilient stand every single week in the face of a regime that's been brutal and doesn't have and doesn't have NATO behind it to help it, that the people have not taken up arms yet, is not disintegrated into a civil war, and that it is also in a in terms of its location, as people say, it is close to the Gulf, and this is the last bastion, the last holdout where you haven't seen, in terms of the oil-rich sheikhdoms, the kind of protests. And once, you know, Syria goes one way or another, that signals to all the holdouts that, you know, if Bashar Assad can't hold on to power, then nobody can.
Now, again, CNN is reporting that Gaddafi forces hold the hotel and the hospital in Tripoli. Now, how significant does that imply that those forces, pro-Gaddafi forces, still are?
I think the hotel, it might be slightly because all the foreign journalists are based in this hotel, and who control the message ultimately will have their voice to the outside world. Yesterday I was watching the reports and this morning, and they were saying basically the spokesman for the government, Ibrahim Musa, is nowhere to be seen, and who was left in the hotel was only the security forces. So this is significant in a way, but I mean, as we see, Diane, the situation is very volatile and changing by the minute. So they might hold it now in an hour or 2 hours, and they might not be able to do so.
And yet the rebels are chanting, Libya is free, Libya is free, David.
That's finished. I mean, there may be holdouts, but there's no chance this regime is going to resurrect itself. It's not like early on where it looked like the rebels were advancing and then it was turned back. There's
All right,
no
Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning, Sarah. Sarah, are you there? Let's try Greensboro, North Carolina. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning. How are you, Diane?
Fine, thanks.
Good. My question is about development. So if the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development were to give loans to the TNC to help rebuild Libya, what conditions would they place on the loans, and how would it shape the future of Libya's economy?
Well, listen, I don't think it's really a matter of money. I mean, part of what the bank can do is loan money, but part of a major part of what it does and what it did in Europe was to rebuild ministries and to help restructure the government in a way that is functional and is along a democratic model. They were extremely successful in Eastern Europe doing this after the fall of the Soviet Union. Libya, as we said earlier, is not going to need a whole lot of money, particularly if it can get these frozen assets back. Britain, I believe, announced today that it was going to return these assets immediately to the TNC, the ones that they hold. But the United States, I would imagine, would be not far behind. So I don't think it's really a matter of money. The conditions would be that they're going to push for democracy, just like the IMF, that there will have to be transparent elections and governance that is, I think, acceptable by a Western standard.
How do you think it is possible, or do you think it's possible that what's happened here could affect what's happening in Syria?
Oh, I think this will be a shot of adrenaline and re-energize a lot of the movements in the region, a sense that Gaddafi, using extraordinary force, was unable to put down this ragtag group of fellows who had limited weapons, had to rebuild arms, were using anti-aircraft guns to adapt them for use on the ground. It's quite extraordinary. I think Syria, especially given the fact that Mubarak is standing trial in Egypt, that there are all these things, this confluence coming together, that signals Assad's in trouble. I think by the end of the year, we will have three more leaders who are out of power. Yemen, President Saleh, Muammar Gaddafi, now almost a given in Libya, and Bashar Assad. And it'll be a close call. I think it's going to take a while in Syria. But it is not tenable for him to remain in power any longer.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show to Grand Rapids, Michigan. Good morning, Isaac.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question. The Scud missiles that are in Gaddafi's inventory, Do they know if the rebels have taken control of them? If not, if Gaddafi's forces still have them, is there a fear he may use those to take out the refineries before all is lost?
David.
I don't think that's a significant concern of most of the people that are watching this. Gaddafi fired off one Scud missile that landed in the middle of a desert. There's not a whole lot of capability, technical expertise on the ground, and these things aren't particularly accurate in any event, and they're not tipped with chemical weapons anymore.
So. Of course, oil prices have gone down today as the result of this. Stock prices have gone up, Nadia.
Absolutely, and this is really good news. I mean, considering the fact, as we said, that the United States only used 2% of Libyan oil, but I think in general in the market there was
European
in particular, and the world. It's just good improvement. And the fact that we might see the price of oil actually returning to the oil prices, this is good news. But also just to comment, not 100%, but cautiously optimistic that might happen, but also add into the military. We don't know if the command structure is intact. I mean, even if he has weapons, if he has surface-to-air missile, etc., we don't know if Gaddafi, sorry, is in hiding, and we don't know where he is, isolated. Who's given the order? Is his command actually structure still there, and they able to give the order to burn the city or to defend him or to defect from him? Or we don't know.
He's no longer capable of taking the offensive. He is now completely in defensive mode. The Scud missiles, if they were ever going to be used, should have been used a long time ago. I don't think that they're a factor anymore. It's really just a matter of his survival and the kind of inner circle, those troops left around him, his ability to attack the refineries, he should have done that a long time ago. He hasn't had access to them for a long time anyway.
Quick question from Abdul in Herndon, Virginia. Good morning. Abdul. Let's try Muhammad in Indianapolis. Good morning to you, sir.
Yes, why hasn't there been any reporting at all on the slaughtering of the black workers that have come into from Africa to work in Libya, and many of them have been just outright slaughtered because they have been seen as those persons who work for Gaddafi and fighting against them?
Well, I think the reports that I heard early on was that everybody who could get out from the expatriate workers that could got out. I'm sure that there were some that could not, but there was really a mass exodus. A lot of the reports that I'm reading about Africans in Libya who have been killed are the mercenaries that that Gaddafi had employed to fight in his service. And you can read about them every day, about the bodies lying in Green Square of the African mercenaries. But I've not heard about, you know, broad spread slaughter of innocent Africans.
Well, let's hope that the slaughter has come to an end. Let us hope that those who are in charge will find a way to bring people together. Thank you all so much, Robin Wright, David Schenker, Nadia Bilbasi, and thank you for all your calls and comments. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Sarah Ashworth, Lisa Dunn, and Nikki Jex. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.